This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
It'd be great to do a round of names, I think. We have newcomers and folks who've been coming for a while alike. So, my name is Andy.
I'm Doug.
Ute.
Ross.
Jonathan.
Nikki.
Michael.
Diane.
Robert.
Mike.
Tim.
Julie. Catherine.
Tom.
Nico.
Todd.
I'm still Andy.
James.
So today, I was thinking about speaking a bit about what is the difference, but also the similarity of anyone on the path, whether one is ordained or not ordained. And I've been thinking about this a lot because it was last October where I finished sewing and received this robe. And it's been, at first it was this, it was almost like this, nervousness, like, oh God, what's going to change? Not really knowing. It's like a teacher of mine once said that, like, say, if you're on a path and if you're on any kind of transformative path, you take one step and you don't know where that foot is going to land yet. And there's a sense of what we might call a lot in Buddhism is groundlessness and space as well. But space is something that we aren't always necessarily comfortable with. We're used to filling up space. We're used to knowing, thinking that we know what's going to happen next. And for me personally, it was they talk in other traditions, they talk about a leap of faith. That something is going to occur, I don't know what. And so that transition has been like that for me, and it continues to be that way. And right when I feel that I take that step and I find ground, it changes. There's another step. There's a different place to land. And I guess that's that may be a fixture of the path from now on, of the really not quite knowing. And maybe that is really truly the ground. And so that's something that I've been reflecting on. And so it kind of brought me into this inquiry with a talk. It's almost like an artistic project that I might be doing. Like if I'm writing music or I'm creating something or writing about something, I just find that I'm fascinated about something. And what I'm fascinated about at that time starts to kind of consume my attention. And so I start to work with it. And organizing talks has been an opportunity to just kind of, it just starts to magnetize these strands of inquiry for me and where the practice has been, what's been active, what's kind of juicy. And so I hope to just kind of share that with you today, and hopefully it's of some interest. So what I've been thinking of is, ordained, not ordained, lay practice, monastic practice, in Buddhism, in Zen in America in the 21st century, here at Jikoji, which is a center of, we're all a mixture of, we're taking up some of these kind of monastic forms, but we're all people in the world. We engage others, we're not renunciates in the classical sense. And we're doing something very interesting. It's almost like a hybridization of some of these Buddhist forms in the past. And that's what I hope to explore. Now, what my exploration kind of brought me to is one particular figure in Chinese Zen. And his name was Layman Pogge. Several of you may have heard of him. And who's heard of Layman Pogge? Great. Good. I get to share some stories, and this, I found out about Layman Pogge because Eric Remington, who is a resident here, posted something up in our office. He tends to study the Dharma there late at night, and several of us get to have encounters with this guy who's here, kind of on personal retreat, and is just devoted to increasing his understanding. And so it's kind of a nice opportunity. I'll knock on his door and say, "Hey, Eric, I've been thinking about this," you know, or something. And, you know, Nico, I know you too. And several of us will just kind of have these nice interactions with him. He's just a wonderful friend of the Dharma. And so he had this, he posted up this saying from Layman Pogge. And what is interesting about Layman Pogge, I'll get to the saying in a moment. I just can't give a little bit of background. Now, he is from about 8th century, Tang Dynasty, and it was he was the son of a provincial Confucian administrator. And it was a time of kind of like really interesting, kind of like different political intrigue of like one person in power and then another. And, you know, like Central Asian invaders were coming in and being fought off. And, you know, Buddhism was like the state religion, and then suddenly it wasn't. It was back to Taoism and Confucianism. There's a lot of changes kind of going through that time. It's not what we're kind of used to, like in our country today. Well, things are constantly changing, but just a different period of history. And the interesting thing about Layman Pogge is that he was a practitioner of Buddhism, you know, raises Confucian, practitioner of Buddhism. And he would spend some time in some of the temples, but he wouldn't linger there. And when he was offered like the black robes of a priest, or even like certificates of enlightenment by teachers, he would decline them. And they were just like, "Well, wouldn't you rather put on something else other than your kind of white robe?" And I guess a white robe that he wore all the time was not even that common, because a white robe was seen as like very plain, you know, during that time. So he just wore this plain white robe. And he just preferred to just keep that robe and not take on the formal practices. But yet he was devoted to the practice, to study and practice. So he had a family. He was actually, what happened during that time is people, there was enough of kind of a merchant class where there was a fair amount of, I guess, kind of an establishment of a kind of middle class where people could accumulate wealth. And he had a tremendous amount of wealth. He was very successful. And at a certain point, he just took all of his family's wealth. He had a son and a daughter and a wife. And he just sank it all in the river. You know, like all the gold, all the kind of precious belongings. He just like dropped it in the river. And then they became this wandering family selling like bamboo utensils, like baskets and whatever else. And just like lived. It almost looked crazy, I imagine, to the people at the time. They just lived like almost within an inch of just like abject poverty, but didn't need much, and they just wandered around and studied the Dharma. And I guess his wife and his son oftentimes would stay at a, they would have, kind of have a homestead too, where they would farm and just kind of be at home. And he and his daughter, who was a close disciple of his, would wander around and travel. And so very interesting guy. And what's interesting about this is that in his own words, he said, "Yeah, I'm well versed in the Buddha way. I go the non-way without abandoning my ordinary man's detail affairs, without abandoning my ordinary man's affairs. The conditioned and name and form are all flowers in the sky, nameless and formless. I leave birth and death." What an interesting statement. He's not leaving or abandoning his ordinary man's affairs. His ordinary affairs. We'll make it more gender neutral and just say not abandoning his ordinary affairs. The conditioned and name and form are all flowers in the sky. Nameless and formless, I leave birth and death. I'm not going to pretend to fully understand this, but I will pretend to explore it.
You read again?
Yeah, gladly. Well versed in the Buddha way, I go the non-way. Without abandoning my ordinary man's affairs, The conditioned and name and form are all flowers in the sky. Nameless and formless, I leave birth and death. So what's interesting to me is that not very much survived of what Layman Pong wrote. I guess he wrote quite a bit. But not much of it survived, but a little bit of it did, because I guess there was a local prefect that took an interest in Layman Pong, and once he died, he kind of collected some of his sayings, and they were kind of passed on. So we just have these little snippets like this one. And what I find interesting about this is that he says he's well-versed in the Buddha way. He goes the non-way without abandoning ordinary affairs. And one thing I've always appreciated about Zen practice is that there's this kind of like, it's not necessarily what I've encountered in some other traditions where it's like one is looking for this kind of otherworldly kind of existence or practice. It's this worldly. It's right here. It's the ordinary. It's an almost a celebration of the ordinary in a way. That might be a strong term to use, but it's just it's a recognition of the ordinary. That is perhaps the magic, is just what's happening right now. And not necessarily abandoning those things. And as practitioners, as non-monastic practitioners, and what I find interesting about the Zen Center model is that it takes some of these monastic practices and it's adapted it to people who want to meditate and want to learn to meditate. And one can. One can practice Zazen, one can study the Dharma, and you don't have to abandon your ordinary affairs. You can still live your life, you know. And I guess I call it like I always try to balance out my path of doing things like this with like doing normal shit, you know. Sometimes the normal things for me are just like, you know, just celebrating a holiday with my family, you know, with my parents and my siblings and nieces and nephews or something, you know. Going to work and just being fully present with what's going on as much as I possibly can, and that really being an extension of the practice and not necessarily distinct from meditation practice. Name and form are all flowers in the sky, nameless and formless, I leave birth and death. And the conditioned and name and form are all flowers in the sky. This is interesting to me, personally. Because in some of my exploration, I was going through the view of monastic and non-monastic practices within Buddhism. And it brought me to a book called Buddha States in India from one of my, I went to Naropa University, it's a Buddhist university in Boulder, Colorado. One of my professors there, his name is Reggie Ray, and he wrote a book called Buddha States in India, and he talks about monastic and non-monastic practices as a theme in that book. And it's a kind of, you know, it's a large, kind of like, it's very dense. Gets into a lot of terminology. But one thing I love about Reggie's books is that it's very clearly written. And he talks about some of the focus of monastic practice was in kind of like in the Theravada tradition or the early Buddhism was pure behavior, which is also sila, or a kind of and also conduct and ethics, and then meditation or samadhi, these are Sanskrit terms, and also scholarly learning and insight or prajna. And people kind of focus on these things. And he said that over time, not in all monasteries, but in a lot of monasticism, what happened was that kind of like there was a lot of busyness even within the institution of a monastic institution, of kind of like one's communal responsibilities, one's responsibilities to the larger community as well. You know, monks might be performing rituals and things. And it's not like these things are bad. These are just what one does. It kind of got collapsed into not as much time for meditation, but, you know, it more kind of like examining the conduct and the pure behavior and the Vinaya code, which is like all these rules, like hundreds of rules that monks and nuns follow. And then also scholarly learning and learning the Dharma and being able to kind of like demonstrate an understanding of it and kind of preserve that part of the lineage. So one of the kind of criticisms, and this is a bit kind of polemical of some of the monastic systems, is that the scholars ousted the saints, is what he said, like the practitioners, some of the deep practitioners, and erudition took the place of attainment. So I thought that was very interesting. And he's not saying it happened everywhere at all times, but it can happen, or perhaps did happen in some of these monastic systems. And one of the kind of interesting things was that, like, you know, monks and, you know, priests or, you know, members of the monastic kind of setting were kind of examined based on, like, well, do they have a good reputation? Is their behavior, kind of their outward behavior, kind of befitting our ideals of what we think this is? And do they demonstrate an understanding? And so that was kind of in relationship to the lay practitioners who would, in turn, support the monastery, you know, and with their kind of like worldly wealth, you know, supporting the monastery in that regard. So again, I find it very interesting. It's like that's not necessarily a setup we have. There are some monasteries here in the U.S., you know, in American Buddhism in general, but it's not... not everywhere. Oftentimes we have these practice centers. It's like it's an amalgam of these things. We're taking kind of our, you might say, our, you know, our Western ingenuity to kind of like just grab things that seem to suit what what's going to work, you know, kind of pragmatism. And Buddhism is changing, you know, and it works different. It kind of manifests differently in each land that it kind of lands on as it's come out of India into these different places. So one of the things that was talked about is that in the same book in Buddhist Saints of India is that meditation seems to require an intensive and sustained practice, like an absence of distraction to a certain extent. And if the monastic setting in some ways, you know, wasn't fostering that for some people, some people left the monastic system, or they decided to not be within institutionalized Buddhism, but they're still Buddhist practitioners. So they're lay practitioners. They might not have fit the status quo at the time. And much like in kind of in the Judeo-Christian tradition, you know, in the Jewish tradition, there were prophets that lived along the River Jordan. And that's one thing that the same author would talk about, Reggie Ray, in that... they would at times come in and they would infuse and kind of revive the tradition. And then they would depart. And sometimes they'd be executed. And that actually, there's an element of that within Buddhism as well, that there are lay practitioners, there are people who were renunciates in a different sense, not necessarily within the institutions of Buddhism, but also outside the institutions. And so I started to look at that, you know. They're cave dwellers in Buddhism, you know. In Tibetan Buddhism, you know, Tibet's great saint, Milarepa, lived in a cave with a lot of his practice. Not all the time, but he did for much of his life. And that's where he practiced. He received his instructions from his guru, Marpa, and lived in a cave. And his guru, Marpa, wasn't a monastic either. He was a translator. He'd go from India to Tibet and had a family and farmed and everything. And his teacher, Naropa, was a former scholar at Nalanda University and left his position, left institutionalized Buddhism to seek his teacher, Talopa. So there's like this line of gurus who also, he found him in a hut with a bunch of rabid dogs, you know. It's just interesting. I think that when we kind of look into these traditions of Buddhism, there are all these practitioners that are considered great practitioners, even founders of lineages, that weren't within the institutions, or maybe they brushed up against them at certain times, but they left, and sometimes they came back. And it wasn't until about four generations in, or five generations in, this is a practice lineage of the Kagyu tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. There's like four main schools, and that's one of them. It was Gampopa who actually founded the monastic tradition in that tradition. And so that I find that interesting. And so that brings me back to Layman Pong in China. Actually, that's a little premature. I mean, just finish this thought, actually. What I also looked at was there's an ancient text in Pali. I hope I'm saying this right. Dutta Gunas. Mike, you familiar with this? Dutta Gunas? Dhutta Gunas. It's Upatissa. This is about the 2nd century Common Era. Yeah. And he talks about there are these different practices that one who's a renunciate that isn't necessarily a monastic can do. And it talks about, you know, like, don't have too many robes, how to beg for food. and it's just, yeah, it's like keeping things minimal. It's like not relying on anything, institutions. It's really this kind of do-it-yourself sort of, you know. That's one thing I always liked about punk. You know, it's like, yeah, DIY, do-it-yourself, you know. It's like in punk rock and Zen kind of have this kind of commonality. Yeah, yeah, it was like there's no money, you know, it's like, so there's this kind of like, you're kind of giving up all these things, you know, and it's this kind of self-reliant kind of practice of, and non-attachment to any of these things, any of these fetters, these things that we can, you know, really just grasp onto. These guys just left all of that, and they had the bravery to do that, and so some of these things are just about like, you know, how many robes you should have, how many meals you should eat, you know, things like that, how to live this life. And then it talks about like, there's about like 11 of these. And then five of these are practices connected with residence. And I find these very interesting because it talks about dwelling in the forest is one of them. Another one is dwelling under a tree. Another one is dwelling in the open air. And the last one is dwelling in the cremation grounds. And actually, the last one is dwelling in any chanced upon place. I'm going to connect this actually to Layman Pong, because actually if you take this text and you actually consider Layman Pong's life with this text, his life becomes so interesting, because dwelling in the forest, it says when the village is crowded, one's mind is touched by the five objects of sense and saturated with the desire for pleasure. When one dwells in a crowded place, one is disturbed by people going and coming. And later in the text it says, thus, the renunciate dwells in solitude in the forest. And the benefits associated with that is one wishes not to become worldly and wishes to gain tranquility. One just has an opportunity to just focus on that. One dwells in solitude, speaks little, and meditates according to one's bent of mind. And the advantages considered are like, you know, there's the beauties of nature, there's the experience of joy of solitude, and it becomes very conducive to meditation. It's quiet. If one is able to release those things and actually just dwell in the forest. And then there's dwelling under a tree was the other one. And that was like giving up dwelling under rooftops. One dwells under a tree. And then dwelling in the open air is just the open sky above you. The benefits are one goes wherever one wills. like a forest deer, and is not attached to any particular place. And one can go in all four directions with no dependence on anything. And I find that interesting. And dwelling in the cremation grounds is, there's also, in the Tibetan tradition, there's actually something called charnel ground practice. And charnel ground was the burial site where they would put bodies to be eaten by, you know, vultures and things. And that's how the sky burials that would happen, actually, in that country quite often. There's one way you could could be what could happen after death. And there are people who actually practice in those places. They took it upon themselves to actually practice right there because the immediacy of death was inescapable. And it's kind of a radical practice, which I think is interesting. It's not necessarily the walls of a monastery. It's a temple of a different kind. And so dwelling in cremation grounds, the benefits, one understands the feeling of the time of death. One perceives that all are impure. One does not cause heedlessness to arise and overcomes passion, detached. One does not fear what common folk dread. One contemplates on the emptiness of the body and rejects the thought of permanence. So when I read that, what struck me is in my exploration is of this text and thinking of, you know, this kind of these ways is that when one takes up a practice for a given period of time, it appears that one might dwell in the forest for a period of time. One might go to cremation grounds and practice there for a period of time and dwell there. We can take on these practices for a period of time. It's like a lot of us, like we'll leave our life and we'll come up here and sit Sesshin for a period of time. We'll dwell in this place and just meditate as a community and actually do it in a way where we can just focus on sitting for a period of time. It's not too different. You know, if dwelling in the forest and dwelling in the open air kind of illuminates your attachment to having a permanent place of residence, or quote unquote permanent, you know, if impermanence is really true, then that's actually, it's not permanent. Just, we grab onto it, we look for security in it, but it's actually groundless. That's actually constantly happening. And that becomes evident when we have to move, you know. When my family moved when I was 12 years old for the first time, we moved twice when I was a child. It's groundless, you know. But then we have the illusion of security again, and we kind of settle into that, and then, you know, back into groundlessness, back into the open air. The last one that of the five places practice connected to residence is any chanced upon place, which a couple of people seem to connect with when I said it. The renunciate renounces the longing which depends on dwelling, and the benefits are you're satisfied with any place. You're able to leave your comforts behind, and you can dwell. One dwells with a heart of compassion. I like that. It's like what happens when you actually give these attachments up? Does it mean leave your home, leave your apartment, give all your stuff away? You know, is that what it means to you not dwell anywhere? Well, maybe, maybe not. You know, I think that maybe we can do these practices and take it on for a while, and then return. And see what happens. So I like that. And the way it goes into Layman Pong's life is that he took all of his security. This is like his retirement. This is everything. This is all of his wealth. And he sank it. He just let it go. He and his family. And they lived a completely different life. Devoted to the Dharma, devoted to practice. And his kind of ability to effectively work with reality gave them just enough to live on, just enough to sustain on. Well versed in the Buddha way, I go the non-way without abandoning my ordinary man's affairs. The conditioned in name and form are all flowers in the sky. Nameless and formless, I leave birth and death. The condition, the name and form, are all flowers in the sky. So when it comes to, you know, ordained and lay practice, for me as well, like this is what Eric, who I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, actually had posted up in the office and actually illuminated a layman pond for me. I have a great robe, not of this world's silk. It can't be dyed any color. Being crystalline, like white floss, no scissors were used to cut it. No thread was used to stitch it. I keep it always closed about me, but there's no man who of himself has seen it. No person who of themselves has seen it. It shelters the entire cosmos from heat and cold, covering over sentient and non-sentient beings alike. Should you be able to obtain its great robe, having donned it, you straightforwardly enter the palace of the King of Emptiness. So for me, my exploration of is there a difference? It's like, what's the relationship? Is there a difference? Ordained life, non-ordained life. If there wasn't any difference, there wouldn't be ordination, it seems, from one perspective. But also, it can't not be that different. There are genuine practitioners, no matter what they're wearing, no matter what formal practices they've taken up or not taken up. And for me, I aspire to keep learning from practitioners of all forms, of all, you know, of all beings, from all corners of one's of life or of the cosmos, or all manners of being. So. I guess that's my sharing of this exploration, and I didn't really know what I was going to say. I just did a lot of reading and thought, and I'm curious how it's landed for any of you. If you have any questions, I definitely welcome some discussion.
Andy?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth mentioning that Lei Wen Peng was considered a completely realized layman, but also his wife and his daughter were also considered completely realized lay persons as well. In fact, in conversations between them, it's often the wife and the daughter who bested Lei Wen Peng himself, as far as, you know, understanding everything.
This is so awesome, Mike. Yeah. Here's one example. This is a really great story. Eric and I were talking about this story the other night. Like, Lei Wen Peng was just talking about, like, you know, the path and how difficult it is. And mm-hmm. They're like, how difficult it is. My studies are like drying the fibers of 10,000 pounds of flax by hanging them in the sun. To this, his wife responded, "Easy, easy, easy. It's like touching your feet to the ground when you get out of bed. I found the teaching right in the tops of flowering plants."
Is it the daughter that says it?
This is his wife, actually. Yeah. But there's so many stories about his daughter, too. Here's a quote from his daughter. Thanks, Mike, for bringing this up. This seems so relevant. She said, "My study is neither difficult nor easy. When I am hungry, I eat. When I am tired, rest." You know, just very similar to, you know, the layman's quote of not abandoning ordinary affairs. Yeah. Also, his death was very interesting. Like, he was on his deathbed for a little while. And I guess they were living in this cave with like a window in the front of it, and he said, you know, "Let me know when it's noon, and then I'll depart," you know. And she said, "Not only is it noon, but the sun is an eclipse. Come see." And he comes and he sees there's a solar eclipse happening, And he's just like, you know, takes in the solar eclipse, and then he looks back, and his daughter actually assumed meditation posture on his bed and died.
What?
Yeah.
She beat him to it.
And that's what he said. And so the thing is, I guess there was a formality of like at least 7 days of mourning. So before he died, he did his 7 days of mourning and then departed himself.
You know, in contrast to their renunciation of their wealth, we have this story that preceded of Vimalakirti, who was a very successful, wealthy businessman and merchant, and he didn't renounce anything, you know. He was in the world, and he was a successful businessman and everything, he was a family man, and you know, he had a household and everything, and he just, you know, he was totally at ease with his abundance or whatever. I mean, there's that side too.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm seeing that there's perhaps such a compliment to what I was emphasizing, you know, with that groundlessness and getting rid of all the wealth, that it isn't necessarily a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Could be. Not necessarily.
Thank you, Mike. I think Casey had her hand up. Yeah.
Just wondering if you've come across specific advice for lay people for the challenges of being lay people, because I think in a way it's easier not to be a lay person, because not that I'm not, you know, I don't know, but I think people are really shaped by their environment, and the idea of like discipline or like self-control is actually, I don't put as much stock that those are as relevant as kind of causes and conditions. So I think of, you know, someone living in a monastery, to me, is inherently going to spend more time devoted to practice than a lay person. So I was wondering if that challenge of being a lay person who is in the world and still having a similar, like, depth or, like, level of commitment to practice was something that had been addressed in what you've come across?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you.
As far as advice. Well,
yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the ways that I really find it relevant is that I was a young guy. I had really like started a career path or anything yet. And it's like, and a lot of people found Buddhism after they had done that. You know, it's like, oh, I did this and this didn't work. And I crashed here. And then like, I found this path, you know, and I'm like, I was really young and found this and didn't know if I wanted to be a monastic or somebody who actually, you know, was a non-monastic at first. I thought for a while that I would actually join a monastery and that was it. And what I think is that, you know, talking to friends who have taken monastic vows for a while, speaking to people, is that it's not necessarily that you're going to be doing more practice in a monastery. There's a lot of other things to do. There's a lot of other things to get distracted by. I think that if one kind of renounces the world, or if you turn your back on one thing, you're facing another thing. I think you're still going to be facing yourself. You're still going to be facing interpersonal things that occur, you know, the institutionalized challenges, you know, that occur. It's all going to be there too, you know. So I think it's really the intention of your practice. Because what I see is that you say, you know, people are shaped by their environments, but I think that also I started Qigong before I started Zen and kind of Tibetan practice. And one of the things that my first Qigong master told me, he just said, like, you know, practice for a while. And he said, after a while, rather than being influenced by your environment, you start to be an influence on your environment. And I thought that was very interesting. And it's a possibility. We tend not to promise anything with Zen practice, you know, but it's a possibility, I think. And one of the ways is that I've been finding too is that on Mondays I've been with Joe Hall, one of the priests that's been affiliated with this community for a while. And Practical Zen, like on Mondays, like we take up little micro practices every day, and you've been there too. And these little micro practices for me like are so helpful because I've taken on this practice for a week, and the practice might be, one of the themes was commitment. Like, why are we not committing to things? You know, like, what's our fear? And so I was like, oh, well, this week I'm going to commit to two things. And then a third thing, I'm going to not commit to one thing too. I'm going to look at that. Because I was seeing how I was being reluctant to work with some things. And so I just decided to enter something fully and join it with practice. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do that. It does take effort. But I mean, one of the things that we can do here in America is that we can actually go to these dharmic environments, or these environments we have set up, you know, centers or even monasteries for a while or whatever, and go to these practice environments, saturate ourselves a little bit, spend some time, and then go back. You know, and that helps, just like these other practices of not dwelling, you know, or these different places to dwell. I think it's very similar. It's no different than actually, say, taking up a practice for a week and like fully doing that. And then following up with it, maybe with a teacher or with a peer or something, or with your journal.
That's really helpful.
Thanks.
Really like what you said about you can be an influence on your environment rather than, you know, just being influenced by your environment. So, thanks.
Yeah, and just follow up with that. It seems to be like that's part of the Bodhisattva vow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I say there's things coming at you, but like, you know, do you have to perpetuate them?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Can you offer it space? You know? Or, you know, you're throwing things out. You know? Do you have to throw those out? Mike, and so.
Well, I was going to mention that, like, in other, not so much in America, but in other cultures, like in Sri Lanka and other places, where there's monastic institutions, and it's almost like they're monastic institutions, and there's like these religious professionals that are monastics, and then there's the lay practice, and they're mutually supportive. Like they, it's almost like you don't just to, for the lay people just to know that there's some religious professionals that have actually. You know, they're not hiding, they're not running away from their lives. They actually choose to specialize and do this one thing of religious practice. In a certain sense, it's it's almost like they're doing it for the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it for you, and they feel supported by these few religious professionals.
Mm-hmm.
That are really specializing and really doing, you know, 100% practice, and it's almost like they feel so. Even though they're not doing the practice, they feel supported by someone who's doing the practice, and it's a very, you know, it's a very nice feeling in those cultures. That it's great. Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, both. I think both can exist, you know, and be totally integrated and supportive,
mm-hmm.
and also, you know, complete in themselves. You know?
Yeah, I often see in America that sometimes that relationship exists within one person.
Yeah, or times of their lives.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And what's interesting to me too is what got me reflecting on this as well, other than Eric's posting of layman Peng or layman Pong. I hope I'm saying his name right. Sorry, layman. was that sometimes that gets rigidified, that's the only way it can be, that the monastic practice is limited to the monastics. There's somebody who came here from Japan once, and they said that, they go, you guys shouldn't be doing these things. This isn't a monastery. Only monastics should be doing these things. So that's where I find it interesting that, you know, we get kind of literal interpretations, or kind of like the concretized sort of mind, that like these roles get clamped down, or it's like these conventions get really solidified. Yeah. Uta, I'm sorry. Didn't want to skip what you were saying. I want to check the time, too.
When you were saying this man dumped all his wealth into the river, because I think this woman, Janis Joplin, maybe she's had this line that freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose.
Nothing to lose?
Nothing left to lose.
Nothing left to lose.
Yeah. And then Mike was saying the person who had all this wealth, there's a huge responsibility with wealth.
Yeah, yeah.
So dumping is freedom.
Wonderful. Wonderful. This is so much fun. And Bob Dylan comes to mind when you say that. There's a line that I heard a Zen teacher quote once, actually. And what is it? He just says, like, just when you thought you've lost everything, you find out you can lose a little more. I think the path continues. The path continues.
Well, I like to think of other areas, and as long as we're talking about musicians, I think of things like, say, Eric Clapton said, there's a lot of really good bedroom guitarists, and so what he was saying is some people play at home, but then don't necessarily know how to work with others, and I think for our own practice, if we want to learn an instrument, we're not going to get better unless we practice. And, I've looked at things like, I went to a master class for a pianist, and there were the high school students who had won these competitions. And so they'd play their piece, and this Angela Hewitt would come up, and she'd just kind of like, this is what you need. And she'd demo it, and they could like, boom, do it, so it's like, I feel like there's all kinds of little things. Like another guy was saying, the best way to improve your understanding of music is to transcribe music, that is, listen and then write it down. So I think it, for our practice, it's like there has to, just like an instrument, you're not going to get better if you don't do anything. And it also takes a certain amount of, like you're saying, putting yourself in different contexts, being skillful and that kind of thing. Being in a band.
I grew as a musician exponentially when I was in a band because I had to. Because the intention was there. I wanted to give to that situation as fully as I could, so that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Thanks, Ross. Especially on the music path. And with that teacher, I'm curious about, like, you say that somebody was struggling with something and they would walk up and just offer exactly what they needed to kind of unlock their ability at the time?
No, it was more like, so you won a competition, there's six students, and they would play their piece, and this Angela Hewitt would give feedback.
Okay.
So she's kind of like, okay, you're teenagers, you're not necessarily the master. And so she would just come in and say, you need more color, and this is what I mean. And then they would try to add color, and they'd redo it, and that kind of thing. Another one would be that you need to, like, not be so on target. You need to, like, be a little less precise. And then the person would try to do that. And these students were so skillful that oftentimes they could just take that feedback and
not be so precise. That's very interesting. Yeah. That reminds me, speaking of rock guitarists and stuff like that, I still really enjoy Jimmy Page. He wasn't the most precise guitar player from Led Zeppelin. He had the phrasing. He knew how to do production, the colors he would pull out, the sounds. I still listen to some of those records, and especially their longer tracks, and I just go, wow. So that's, I enjoy that. Thanks, Ross. Yeah. Bring a little pop culture into this. Should we go to lunch? What do you think?
Just
one more? Yeah.
One thing that struck me in a monastery setting as a layperson since more than a decade is the Sangha and the probability to be with kindred spirits. Following for the practice, as you said, you have this mini practice per week, and just be not the only one who's doing it strengthens the core. And like for me, observing different monastery settings around the world in Zen, Buddhistic Zen, has struck me as one of the key assets of a monastery is kindred spirit. And that what attracts me here. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for reminding us the importance of Sangha as one of the three jewels. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.